Many years ago, there was a set of newspaper cartoons that showed up as a serial basis. And this was so popular that eventually a movie and a TV series was made out of it. And eventually they made even, they revisited it and a new series was made. And of course, I'm talking about Superman. People would say, it's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's Superman. And as we all know, there was behind the man in the red and blue suit, Clark Kent. Now, if Superman was one who could tackle all of the problems that would ever happen in Metropolis, Clark Kent just didn't look like he could take care of much of anything. Maybe he could barely take care of himself. Now, within the Superman series, of course, we know that Clark Kent was never trying to reveal himself, but people would start finding out that, hey, wait a moment, why is it that we never see Clark Kent and Superman together, even though Clark Kent went to get Superman, and Superman only came back. And so some people would kind of catch on to the thing and say, well, you know, I think Clark might be Superman. And everyone would say, nah, no way. It just couldn't be. But here and there, some people would start figuring it out, but then things would happen so that they'd be discredited. Interestingly enough, as we look at the Gospel of John, there are some parallels. Because Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, came to planet Earth and he lived among his own people and he revealed himself. He was light. He was there making it so that people could see who he was, that indeed he grants everlasting life to believers. But what would happen? People would say, nah, Jesus, he's a nobody. And they'd be thinking, wow, it'd be wonderful if God sent his Messiah, but they'd look at Jesus and they just wouldn't see it. And yet Jesus kept doing sign after sign after sign. He kept giving evidence of who he is. And overwhelmingly, he was rejected. John's testimony, and we've seen that that's the better title for this book, is devoted to showing us that Jesus demonstrated throughout his ministry that he is who he says he is, and he does what he says he does. He gave a sufficient case, and yet, overwhelmingly, he was rejected. What we are going to see here in the prologue, as we take our second look at the prologue, is that the evidence is laid out. What John wants his readers to know is that they shouldn't be measuring whether Jesus is a Messiah by whether he was accepted by the leadership of the nation, or whether he was overwhelmingly accepted by the nation. The test of who he is based upon, did he demonstrate that he met the credentials? Do his signs show that indeed he is who he says he is? John wants the reader to understand, full disclosure at the beginning, that everything was done to make it so that people would comprehend who he is. And yet, they'd look at him and they'd say, he's Clark Kent. They just didn't get it. They didn't get it that he is the creator and he is the Messiah who came to grant everlasting life to all believers. And they just did not get it. As we have seen, page one of the notes, this is John's testimony. We know that the Gospel of John, or the testimony of John, was written before the year 70, because in John chapter 5, verse 2, it says, "Now by the sheep gate in Jerusalem there is a pool called Bethesda in Hebrew, which has five colonnades." That has been discovered, that particular pool, but it is a pool that was destroyed during 70, during the invasion by the Romans of Jerusalem. But notice it says that it is there. It doesn't say it was there. John, as he is writing, is testifying to that pool being there. It's present. John wrote before 70. I'll let you in on a little secret. I believe that every book of the New Testament except for Revelation was written before 70. And there's a very simple reason for that. The greatest apologetic, other than the cross and resurrection, that could be used to demonstrate the truth of the first century message would be to look back at the predictions of the destruction of Jerusalem that would be forthcoming in 70. Interestingly enough, every New Testament book that makes any allusion to it treats it as a yet future event, and there is not one of them, not one New Testament book that looks back and says, "Aha, see? Fulfillment of what Jesus had said. Fulfillment of even what Daniel chapter 9 had said." So this is evidence that John is written before the year 70. But I think we can push it even further back to before the year 44. The year 44 is when Cornelius, who was the first non-proselyte Gentile in the church, after Cornelius, what we have is the New Testament puts a focus on Jews and Gentiles. But when you look at the Gospel of John, you look at John's testimony, and where is the focus? It is to the nation of Israel. To the southern tribes, Judah. To the northern tribes, Israel. To those in the central region, Samaria, that were originally part of the northern tribes of Israel, and to diaspora Jews. There is no Gentile ministry, no Gentile mission recorded in the Gospel of John, even though Mark and Luke do make mention of Jesus having an outreach, a ministry to Gentiles. Some of you might be thinking, but wait a moment, aren't Samaritans Gentiles? You're right, they aren't. They are Jews. How do we know this? Acts chapter 8 speaks about Philip going up to Samaria. Is 8 before 10? Yes. Okay, when we get to Acts chapter 10, we have the ministry of Peter to Cornelius. And Cornelius is regarded by God as the first Gentile within the church. What does that tell us about the Samaritan believers in Acts chapter 8? They were regarded as Jews. Now, I have to tell you, racism is something that is pervasive and has been on planet Earth ever since not all that long after the Garden of Eden. And it is Jewish, Judean propaganda that referred to Samaritans as half-breeds. They were regarded by God as Jews. John's gospel is focused upon the ministry that occurred among Jewish people of all types. Judeans, Samaritans, Israelites, and the diaspora Jews. That is pointing to the Gospel of John being written before 44, before the conversion of Cornelius. Now, you might have a question that arises in your mind. Well, if this book was written to Jews, then is it any good for us? You better believe it. Because is there now, after 44, any difference between Jews and Gentiles with regard to their access to God? No. Is there any difference in the message that would be given to either? No. But John is written early. John is an early testimony of Jesus. Now, when we think about the audience and the purpose for writing, take a look at that purpose statement, which is in John 20, 31. These eight signs are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing this, you may have life in his name. Notice the repetition of the word you. The readers need to believe, and the readers need life. What does this mean that the readers are? The readers are unbelievers who lack life. Do you know what an unbeliever is? An unbeliever is a professional at not getting the point. They've spent their whole life missing the point. What better tool than the book that is designed for those people? If you're going to talk with an unbeliever, where do you want to start? The book that God has written for the unbeliever. Now, obviously, when we go and we talk with people, we get questions about James, we get questions about all sorts of other passages. Of course, we'll go to those other books, but where is it that we would want to start? We would want to start with the book that is written for the unbeliever. It is the book that is designed for them and presupposes the least amount of content already to be believed. As we look at that purpose statement a little more closely, though, there are eight signs that Jesus did that are recorded here within John's testimony. They are ones that occurred during the time that John was present with Jesus. And we see that by comparing John chapter 2, verse 11, 453, 20, 30, and 31, and 21, 24, and 25. John is able to testify of the signs that are recorded here in this book because they started, the ones that he recorded at least, started in Galilee after John started following Jesus. Therefore, he's able to testify in a court of law, these signs I saw Jesus do, these signs that demonstrate that he is the Christ, the Son of God, the one who gives life to believers. As we look at this prologue a little more closely, we'll notice that there are several important words that are going to be carried on throughout the Gospel of John. The Word, that is Christ. Now, John does not mention the term Word as a reference to Christ after the prologue, but Christ does receive attention throughout the book. The life versus death issue. Light versus darkness. Witness and testimony. Believing the Father, the Son. Grace itself is not mentioned beyond this point, but truth and glory. So this is indeed a point to get started for the reader, telling him some of the things that he's going to be encountering. Some of the statements here in the prologue may seem a bit enigmatic, but the book is designed to unfold the truth. We will now review what we covered last time on the first five verses of this book. Statement 4:1:1, Christ was eternally with God, and he also was, as well as is, God. Christ was eternally with God, and also was, and is, God. John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, the term that's used, Word, is a reference to Jesus Christ, as we can see very clearly. As you are probably aware, in Greek, that word is logos, but it is actually standing here for an Aramaic term, memra. Now, the A that's at the end of the word memra is the article, so it'd be the word. And rabbis had an interesting set of discussions that were going on during the first century. They would say that the memra did this and the memra did that. And they would look at such activities as creation and looking on towards the deliverance of the nation of Israel, and they would account for it as the memra is who will do this. But then there was an interesting discussion among the rabbis. One group said the memra is God. And another group said, oh, no, it's not God. It's an angel. It's a messenger. It's an agent that God uses, but the memra isn't God. What is it that John here says? The word, the logos, the memra, goes back to the very beginning. Goes back to eternity past. Kind of sounds like God, doesn't it? Besides that, though the memra, the logos, was with God. Sounds like an agent of God, doesn't it? But then where does he finish up? The logos was God. John is essentially entering into a debate that was existing during the first century, and he's saying, Jesus, the Word, the Logos, the Memra, is both with God as his agent, and he is God. So, John chapter 1, verses 1, B, and C answers the rabbi's difficulty. Christ is both God and God's agent. Now, we need to spend a little bit of time with this passage because Jehovah's Witnesses have thoroughly confused this passage. And many believers look at this passage and don't quite know what to make of it because of having had discussions with them, with Jehovah's Witnesses. Essentially, the problem that Jehovah's Witnesses had was they couldn't imagine Christ being both God and God's agent. And so what they do is they capitalize God the first time it appears in the verse, and they put it in lowercase, no capital letter, the second time. So their translation says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, that is, they would say, Jehovah God, and the Word was a God. Notice what they've done. That's polytheism. There's more than one God in their system. You notice that? Jehovah God receives worship and a God receives worship, legitimate worship. They have created polytheism. Their problem is they don't know how to deal with him both being God and God's agent. Before we go into saying what it is that the passage actually teaches, I'd like to show that Jehovah's Witnesses are inconsistent in their handling of John chapter 1. They basically have said that there's a rule that John is showing us, and that rule is if the word the appears before God, then it's Jehovah God, capitalized G. But if there is not an article, if the word the does not appear before God in Greek, they would say, then that's a God. That's not Jehovah God. Okay, well, let's look at the chart down at the bottom of page 2 of your notes. If we were to look at the New World Translation or the Kingdom Interlinear, we would notice some interesting things. Now, in verse 1a, the word the, and it's ton in front of theon, shows up. So if they're following their rule, which they say they are, they would capitalize it, and indeed they do. And then in verse 1b, there is no the in front of it. It's just theos by itself. And so they don't capitalize it. So far, they're being consistent. And then we go to verse 18b. Now, depending on whether you're using the Living Water, New King James or Old King James on one hand, or another version, the number of times the word God shows up in verse 18 will be different. If you look in your Living Water, notice that it has the word God once, and then where it says the only begotten Son is the place, instead of saying Son, the critical text, which the Jehovah's Witnesses follow, would say God. Well, in that particular place, in their Greek text, there is no article, and it's the word God, and they render it with a lowercase, the only begotten God, lowercase. But four other times, verse 6, verse 12, verse 13, and verse 18a, the word God appears with no article, no the in front of it in Greek. Guess what? They render it as capitalized G each of those four times. This is one of those cases of a very important hermeneutical concept being applied. It's called heads I win, tails you lose. They make up a rule, an imaginary rule in verse 1, and they say, oh, look at our wonderful rule. John's telling us that our theology is right. And then look at verse 6. Oh, well, we'll pretend that we didn't say anything about that rule. Verse 12, we'll pretend we didn't say anything about that rule. Verse 18a, we'll pretend we didn't say anything about that rule. Heads I win, tails you lose. And observe. The text doesn't support what they're trying to do. If they applied their own rule, they'd see a problem. Okay, so it's one thing to say that the Jehovah's Witness translation is incorrect and is inconsistent, and that it's theologically self-serving. But it's important for me to go beyond that. It's important that we come away knowing what is John seeking to do. Let's turn to page 3 of the notes. This is going to be where Steve's charts may make the point a little simpler. We've talked last week about what's here on the notes on page 3. There are times when the word is or are will act as an equal sign, but most of the time it does not. In my first paragraph on page 3, I speak about the one type of situation where is will function like an equal sign, and that is when you have reversible predicate nominative sentences. And so most sentences are not of this type. So it is usually good to differentiate a subject, which in English we'll put first, and a predicate nominative, which in English we'll put last. And what I have here is a couple of examples. 12, as in 12 eggs, is a dozen. 12 eggs is a dozen eggs, right? And a dozen is 12. If I switch that sentence around, it means exactly the same thing, and there's no problem. It's a reversible sentence. When a sentence is reversible, then is would be equivalent to an equal sign. But most of the time, we have sentences that do not set up a reversible situation. Do notice that We're using red and blue boxes around words in order to say which is subject, which is predicate nominative. Now we have a more common type of sentence, and that is the subset proposition. This is far more common. Remember, I had my fellow elders come up here, and I said that use each one of us as an example. Said that Frank Tyler is a human. Ricardo Campos is a human. John Niemela is a human. And I can say, the elders are human. Now, on the other hand, if we tried to switch that one around and we said, human is John Niemela, they say, boy, when I see the word human, I don't normally think of one particular individual. What we have is human is a broad category into which lots and lots and lots of individuals fit. And then we have an example. When you have a subset, it just doesn't work when you change it around and try to make it interchangeable. Is not an equal sign when you have a non-reversible or a subset proposition. Notice here we have the statement, fathers are males. True statement. And the reason it's true is because males is a larger category and fathers are a subset. We wouldn't say to someone who says, I'm male, and you say, well, are you a father? The person says, no, well, then you're not male. We wouldn't do that, would we? Okay. Obviously, male is a larger category, and father is a subset of it. We can make the statement, fathers are males, and that works fine. But what happens if I say, males are fathers? Not always. This is what we mean when we say that is not an equal sign. That becomes very important here in this passage. It becomes of extreme importance because we're going to see that John is using typical Greek grammar. Now, we're using as a mnemonic green because green sounds like Greek. So where you see green on the right, on the left-hand side, that's saying even though you see all English letters, pretend that these are words that are in Greek. So up on the upper part, we can say the fathers, because here's what happens in Greek. Greek will say which one's the subject by putting the word the in front of it. And the word that doesn't have the in front of it will be the predicate nominative. So we have a sentence in Greek, and it's in this word order. The fathers are males. How do we translate that into English? The fathers are males. But notice on the bottom set, it says males are the fathers. That's the word order in Greek. But guess what we do? We put the and the word that follows it at the beginning of our English sentence because that's where English puts the subject. So it translates into the fathers are males. Now guess what John 1:1c looks like in Greek. Look at your English Bible, look at your living water, and I'll give you a literal word-for-word translation of what it says in the Greek text. It says, and God was the Word. The Greek says, literally, and God was the Word. What's our rule? How do we convert it into good English that people will understand what's meant? We take the word that has the in front of it, and we put that at the beginning of our sentence. And then we put the verb, and then we put the other word. Okay, example. Look at the bottom of this chart that's up on the overhead. Literally, the text says, males are the fathers. How do we translate it? The fathers are males. Notice the bottom example. The Greek word order. God was the Word. When we translate it into English, we know that the subject, the word that we're going to put first in our translation, will have the word the in front of it. Which word has the in front of it? Word. So we translate it, the Word was God. Even though the Greek says, God was the Word. Because Greek tells us which is the subject by putting the in front of it. How does English tell us which is the subject? It puts it first. So if we're going to translate it correctly, we have to put it in the right English word order. What's funny is this. The Jehovah's Witness translation reverses the word order, and then they choose to put the word A in front of God and make it lowercase. So they recognize that the article is telling which is the subject, and then they try to make a second point out of it. That's unfair. Now, it's extremely important here that we understand that this is a qualitative type of a statement. Let me make this easier. Let me pretend that it doesn't say God. I'm going to put an adjective. And the adjective that I'm going to put is divine. The Word was divine. He has all the characteristics of God. Why? Because he is God. Notice, could we say, divine was the Word. Would we make the subject divine? No, that's not good English. Now, there's an important thing about when we have words that are qualitative predicate nominatives. Qualitative just means it's functioning like an adjective. Divine is an adjective. God is a noun, but it's functioning like an adjective. It's saying that he belongs to the category of God. Let's use as an exemplar these statements. Okay, here we go. This is the one we'll use. I have a chart, a pie chart here, in which I'm using the circle to indicate God. God is a Trinity. We have the Father is God, the Son is God, the Spirit is God. Would we say the Father, Son, and Spirit are gods? No, we wouldn't. We would say the Father, Son, and Spirit are God, singular. We can say that each of them individually is God, that is, each one of them belongs to the category of God. God exists as a Trinity. And what John is saying here in John 1:1c is that Jesus belongs to the category of God. We could expand it out a little bit and say he's part of the Trinity. He's God. Is he all of God? No. Would it be true to say that the Trinity was Christ? No. Notice, it's not a reversible statement. We can say that Jesus is God, but we can't say God is Jesus because The larger category is the one that goes into the predicate nominative slot. Jesus belongs to the category of God, but God does not belong to the category of Jesus. Which is bigger, God or Jesus? God, because the Father and the Spirit also are God. What is it that John is saying through this? Jesus is God, and he was also with the Father, who is also God. He could have also said, and he's with the Spirit, who is God. But together, they don't make up three gods. Together, they are the one triune God. What is going on here is John is explaining Jesus as the Memra. Jesus is the one that the rabbis would say, who did it? God's agent or God? And some rabbis would say, it's God's agent that does this. And others would say, oh, no, no, it's God who does it. But what does John say? It's God, the Word, Jesus Christ, who is also God's agent. What John is doing in this is he's acquainting the reader with the idea that he's going to answer a problem that really bothered first century Jewish theologians. Jesus is God, and Jesus is God's agent. And all of the book is designed to demonstrate who he is and what it is that he does. Let's go on now to page 4, and we'll consider the way that this fits together. As a qualitative predicate nominative, we would not make it plural. We would not say that the Father, Son, and Spirit are gods. Just as when we say Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z are human, we don't need to say S, put an S on it, humans. In the case of humans or human, either would be true. It's true whether we put the S or whether we don't. But when we're talking about God, there's only one God. It's interesting, when you talk with Jewish people about their Messiah, Jesus Christ, you tend to hear a couple of interesting things. Oh, you Christians worship three gods. Wrong. We have one God. One God that exists in the Trinity. And furthermore, the Old Testament, and remember we were in Genesis, gives lots and lots of hints as early as Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, that God exists in the Trinity. Furthermore, Jewish people will often say that Christianity is about man becoming God. Wrong. It's about God becoming man. It's an entirely different picture that Jesus, who has been God for all of eternity and was with the rest of the Trinity, at a point in time became human without ceasing to be God. So how we summarize John 1:1 is Christ was eternally with God and also was and is God. He's God and he's God's agent. Verse 2 then tells us that he has been with the Father for all of eternity. He was in the beginning with God. And so it's referring once again, giving emphasis to the eternality of Jesus Christ. Verse 3 then says that the Word, Christ, was the agent of all creation. All things were made through him, and apart from him, not one thing was made that has been made. He is the Creator. When we have been looking at Genesis, and it speaks about creation in the 6 days, dealing with the formlessness and the voidness, Who is it that was acting? It was Jesus Christ. Colossians chapter 1 also goes into great detail about that. No exceptions. Christ was the agent of creation, and he is God. Verses 4 and 5, Christ embodies life. And as an important contextual note, death does not enlighten. So he, the one who embodies life, is the only light source in the world, but the world did not apprehend the light. It did not apprehend his message. John 1, 4 and 5 reads, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, yet the darkness did not grasp it or did not seize it." John likes plays on words, and the word here could be grasp in the sense of understanding or seize, as in trying to arrest him or trying to destroy him. The world neither understood nor destroyed the message. They accomplished neither one of those. The world may have a concept of God, but when it looks at Jesus Christ, Jesus did not meet their expectations. It's kind of like all the people looked at Clark Kent and said, "He can hardly manage his own life. How could he be the deliverer of Metropolis?" People look and they don't see. They look at the Creator who has enshrouded himself in light, and there is no darkness. He's perfectly clear as to who he is, and by and large, he was not comprehended. His message was missed. Now, getting into new exposition. Verses 6 through 8, God sent John the Baptist, who, John tells us specifically, was not the light. God sent John the Baptist to testify about the light, that is, to testify about Christ, to give everyone opportunity to believe in Christ. Verses 6 and 7. A man appeared, sent from God, whose name was John. He came to give testimony, to testify about the light, so that all might believe through him. Now, the expectation is not that every single person of the earth would believe in him, but opportunity is given to them. This is obviously a passage that would be taken out of context by hyper-Calvinists to say that the world is to be defined as the world of the elect, and that, as we'll see, plenty of evidence within the Gospel of John itself simply does not fly. John was sent to testify, and the purpose of his testimony was to make it possible for everyone to believe. Now, it is interesting, though, when you look at what is it that they are to believe. Notice there's no direct object. Notice it says that he gave testimony concerning the light that all might believe through him. Now, we've talked previously about the word believe and the types of objects it takes. It takes two types of objects, and an easy passage for us to see this is John chapter 4, verse 20. This will help us to see grammatically something useful for figuring out the passage that we are looking at. Jesus is talking with a Samaritan woman. "Woman," Jesus told her, "believe me. A time is coming when you will not worship the Father either on this mountain or in Jerusalem." Now, who is supposed to be believed? Jesus. Notice, believe me. What is supposed to be believed? The content that Jesus spoke. Believe that a time is coming when you will not worship the Father either on this mountain or in Jerusalem. Okay, let's imagine that you are a juror and you are in a courtroom setting and there has been testimony that has been given by a witness. And one juror says, I believe the testimony given by that witness. And another juror says, I believe that witness. Now, should the two of those jurors duke it out? Are they in disagreement with each other? No. How can I believe a witness without believing what the witness said? How can I believe what a witness said without believing the witness? What we see in the Gospel of John time and time again is that the witness, the person who speaks, is often referred to as the object of faith. And often at other times, the testimony given by that witness is what is mentioned. When one believes the testimony that is given by a witness, they have believed the witness. When one has believed the witness, they have believed what that witness has said. Okay, let's go back to John chapter 1. What are these people supposed to believe? Well, one could say, in order that all might believe John's testimony concerning the Christ. Or we could say that they might believe in Jesus Christ. Or we might say that they believe the message that was given by John. Or we might say in order that they might believe what Jesus said. Or that they might believe what the Father had said about Jesus that John clued them in on. All of those end up being compatible. The point is, John gave testimony in order that that testimony would be believed. Now, within the Gospel of John, in the majority text, we find the word believe 100 times. Critical text, we find it 99 times. But in any text, it's quite common. The word testify, testimony, and witness are also very common terms. But what is the response that is elicited when testimony is given? Is for someone to believe it or for someone to disbelieve it? John is saying that he is giving expert testimony that could be, that John the Baptist gave testimony that would stand in a court of law regarding Jesus Christ in order that people would believe in him. As we move now from an emphasis upon what John did to an explanation of Jesus Christ, verses 9 and 10, I would state it, although Christ gave light to everyone who was born into the world that he created, the world ignored the light. That is, the world ignored Christ. Although Christ gave light to everyone who was born into the world that he created, the world ignored the light. They ignored Christ. Verses 9 and 10. That, namely Christ, was the true light, which gives light to everyone who comes into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. The world looks at him as Metropolis looked on Clark Kent. They say, what does he have to do with anything? Whereas instead, it is the Creator revealing himself within his creation. Now the question becomes, did he really give light to everyone? It says, a more literal rendering would be that he gives light to every man coming into the world. The word man there is generic for men and women. They come into the world via birth, so he's talking about those who are born. He gives light to everyone. Does it mean that he gives so much light that everyone receives life? No. There is enough light that everyone is accountable, everyone is responsible to believe in him. Sufficient testimony has been given. And you might say, well, how did he do this? Did Jesus meet every single person on planet Earth? How is it that he gives light to everyone? Well, glad you asked. Take a look over at Romans chapter 1. See, I do believe there are other books in the Bible besides the one that I'm teaching out of. Romans chapter 1, starting with verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed. Now, did it say it will be revealed? No, it says it is revealed right now. Guess what? Wrath is always in the Bible a term that speaks of things that happen in time, in history. Lake of fire is not wrath. It's a temporal concept. It's not speaking about a future wrath. It's talking about a wrath right now. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. That's a present concept. Because what may be known of God is manifested in them, for God has shown it to them. Take a guess which member of the Trinity functioned as the agent to do this. The Son. For since the creation of the world, who did creation? The Son. His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Basically, God is revealed in his creation. When one looks at a 747 jetliner, does one say, oh, interesting accident. How did that come together? Was it that there was a real strong windstorm and it all of a sudden blew all of those molecules together and we have a 747? Or was it intelligent design? All of creation points to there being a creator. All creation points towards life being granted by the Creator. What Paul is saying here in Romans is that God has revealed himself in creation. Who did creation? Jesus Christ. But besides the witness of Jesus through creation, did they in first century Israel have God's word? You better believe they did. Guess what? God revealed himself in there. Was he pointing towards the Messiah coming? Absolutely. What did we see happen when the wise men came and they said, where is he who is born king of the Jews? They said, oh, we don't know about a book called Micah that says where he's supposed to be born. They told him, go to Bethlehem. That's where he's to be born. They had God's word. And throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus is going to remind people that everything that was written in the law and the prophets and the Psalms, just as Ricardo reminded us this morning in going to Jeremiah, pointed towards Christ. And Jesus is responsible for revelation of the word happening. Now, it happened through the Holy Spirit as the one who actually carried it out. And then besides that, Jesus met with people. So guess what? Everyone has sufficient light to be responsible for the truth. But the unfortunate thing is people like to ignore the truth that they have. And so the Creator, here as we look back at John chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, is the true light who gives light to everyone coming into the world. And yet, despite that, and despite the fact that in verse 10 he was in the world, he came at a point in time, and although the world was made through him, the world did not know him. They ignored him. They treated him as irrelevant, and they rejected his message. He just didn't look like what they were expecting. And as a result of not expecting it, they didn't see it. Verses 11 and 12 look more particularly at the response within Israel, whereas this is a general response to the Creator coming into his creation and being ignored and rejected by his creation. Now he came to his own things. Interestingly enough, he came to his own is a neuter form. It's not a masculine form there. So Christ came to his own things, the world which he created. But even his own, that's a masculine form, his own people rejected him. But those who accepted him by believing in him become children of God, being born not by bloodlines, being born not by sexual lust, nor being born by a husband's will, but born by God. Let's read the verses 11 and 12. He came to his own, that is his own things, and his own people did not accept him. But as many as did accept him, he gave the right to be God's children to those who believed in his name. Christ came into that which he created. And we could expect that, okay, there might by and large be rejection of him among the Gentiles. But even among his own people, there was overwhelming rejection. But those who accepted him, that is, who did not reject him, well, what does it mean to accept Jesus? Wow, that's a popular way of inviting people to get saved. But what does it mean? It is such an ambiguous term that John needed to add to those who believe in his name. The way that one receives or accepts Jesus is by believing in him. Now, they become children of God. And notice, Jesus, as God and God's agent, is authorized to authorize believers to become God's children. But notice it says, who are born not of blood. The word for blood is not singular. The word for blood is plural. There are two basic usages for the plural in Hebrew of blood. This is in Greek, but it's Hebrew thinking. One would be a violent death, and another is bloodlines. And I would take it within this context. He's saying, you don't have a family tree that results in becoming regenerated. Not a family tree. It's not bloodlines that yields being born again or having everlasting life, becoming children of God. Nor is it by the will of the flesh. That is, it's not by sexual lust. Sexual lust doesn't produce it. Nor by being born by a husband's will. Now, the word here is translated as, in verse 13, the will of men, but the word is not anthropos. Anthropos is generic. It can be man or woman. But the word that's here is aner. And aner is quite often translated husband. It is a term for a male man, not a post office worker, but a male type of man. So in other words, not the will of the husband, not the will of the one who says, gee, let's do something tonight that will make it so we'll have a kid. That is not how one becomes a child of God. It is God who is the agent of people becoming God's children. And notice, who is it that's authorized to make them into God's children? Jesus Christ. He's the one authorized to give life in his name. One receives Jesus by believing in him. That's the way that one becomes a child of God. Now, in verse 13, when it says, as many as received him, I think the emphasis within this passage is as many Israelites, as many Judeans, Galileans, Samaritans, and diaspora Jews. The reason that I would say that that's the emphasis is because that's where this book goes, with a focus upon Israel believing in their Messiah to receive individually life. Although that's the emphasis, within the passage there has been a talk about creation in general, which then looks at Gentiles more distantly. But as many of his own, and as many who were not of his own, who believed in him, he gave life. Take a look at page one for a moment. This is where the title for this message came from, in part. Grace and Truth from the Rejected Messiah. How would we, if we were in a position like what Jesus had, would come and look at the overwhelming rejection and say, smash, and just destroy it all? What we see is grace. Despite being overwhelmingly rejected by his own people within his own things, that is, the creation that he himself effected, he continues to offer life to those who believe. He didn't just say, smash and destroy it all. His grace is evident. Despite being rejected, he continues to offer life. Verse 14 then speaks about the Creator being a tent dweller. If you were to look at the Old King James, it says that he tabernacled among us, and people always puzzle, what does it mean he tabernacled? Well, the picture here, the verb is skenao in the Greek. Now, Greek did not have an SH sound. So whenever Hebrew had the letter sheen and there would be a sh type of sound, Greek would just put an S. Skenao. Shekinah. The Shekinah dwelt in a tent. Remember, the tabernacle was a tent. And he skenaoed. He tabernacled. Do you see how the Old King James got its rendering? He dwelt in a tent. But this isn't just a Bedouin tent. What kind of a tent is it? Ah, let's look a little more closely at verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt in a tent among us, and we saw his glory. We saw his Shekinah. Who is we? Who is we? For a clue, look at John chapter 21, verses 24 and 25. This is the disciple who testifies to these things and wrote them down, and we know that his testimony is true. Yes, there are many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I don't suppose even the world itself could contain the books that would be written. Did the world as a whole see his glory? Oh, they looked at him like a Clark Kent. They didn't see his glory. Who saw his glory? He tabernacled among us. Who's the us? The 11 disciples, other than Judas. Oh, yes, he was within the nation of Israel. But in particular, who was it that he was there with day in and day out that they might be able to see his glory as he reveals himself to them? It's the 11. John is saying, despite the fact that he came into his world and he was a light who shed light throughout the world for people to see who he is, by and large, he was rejected, but we saw who he was. We saw his glory. We saw him do his signs. We saw evidence that he is sent from God. And he, as far as we're concerned, was the Shekinah glory, and we were in a tent there right with him. See the picture? John is contrasting what he saw with what everyone else didn't see. But what is it that this book is designed to do? It's designed to help the reader be able to look and see what the reader would not see apart from God's revelation in this book. You might look at the living water as God's spectacles that he gives to us, so we can look at it and we can see. And so that we can talk with unbelievers and help them to see who it is that they are to see out of this book. Now, verses 15 through 18 then carry on seeing the glory of God's only begotten Son, full of grace and truth, fully God, manifesting both grace as well as truth. So we look at verses 15 through 18. We see what John the Baptist specifically taught in his proclaiming of his testimony. Now, if you have a New King James, I would like for you to open up to John chapter 1, verses 15 through 18, or whatever translation you happen to have with you, but also open up in your Living Water. And I hope that these have been passed out to everyone who doesn't have, so I hope no one doesn't, that everyone does have. There's an important feature here in the text. Notice if you look at verse 15 in your New King James or most translations, it will end with quotation marks. Now look at the Living Water. The Living Water ends the quotation marks in verse 18. I'm going to point something out. What we have in verse 15 is it stating that John bore witness and his testimony occupies the rest of the prologue. It goes all the way through verse 18. This is what John is saying, that is, John the Baptist. It is not John's, the apostle's, editorial remarks in verses 16 through 18. John the Baptist speaks the entirety of 15 through 18. John the Baptist testified that Christ was the preeminent, pre-existing one who came chronologically after him, who lavished divine grace and truth upon all, even beyond the grace given by Moses in the law. Namely, Christ proclaimed the Father. As we look at this, John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, "This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me." John's ministry started about 6 months before Jesus' ministry, and he was told that when he saw that one upon whom the Spirit descended as a dove and remained, that he is the one that was the Christ. But Christ pre-existed him, and he is preeminent over John, despite the fact that John announced him. John came first, announcing one greater to follow. John testifies, "And of his fullness we have all received grace instead of or upon grace." John knows that this is God, and he knows it's God's agent. And even though John, at the time he's testifying, had not seen much of Jesus, it had been revealed to him just how strategic Jesus is in the plan of God. He's God, he's God's agent, and John is saying, wow, everything that preceded that had an agent, that agent was Jesus. And so he can say, of his fullness of deity, we have all received. We have received, we are beneficiaries of Jesus Christ and what he has done before. Explanation. For the law was given through Moses. John knows this. Was there grace in the law? Absolutely. Was there truth in the law? Absolutely. Verse 16b or 17b is saying that preeminently grace and truth came through Jesus Christ, because who was responsible? Who was behind the revelation of Moses? Who was behind the law? Who is the agent of God who works with men? Jesus Christ. He's saying, don't look to Moses. Look to Jesus, who underlies Moses and who goes beyond Moses. No one has seen God, that is God the Father, at any time. The only begotten Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. What we have is John the Baptist is saying, look to Christ, and you're going to get the preeminent revelation of God the Father and of his working through Christ in time, history, and for his plan for the ages. John is saying, come and see. We might look and we might see Clark Kent. John says, there's something even better than Superman. What he's going to do all the way through this book is he's going to be pointing towards Jesus Christ, that the world looked at and sees nothing, but through whom the world was created, and life for those who believe in his name comes. John is telling us, don't take the world's word for it. Take the message of life. The message of life is where it is presented. Gospel of John, the testimony of John.